Hundreds again. We smell it now.
If you were tonight in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is in Indian Territory in the United States, and you were to visit as a trick-or-treater with your masks and your costumes on the home of Don and Kathy Henry, you would not see one pumpkin like that one, which Don cut, smiling at you. But you would see two, a happy one and a scowling one, is I think the way he described it. So in order to compensate for your loss, we will try to make things a little grimmer. Looking at Marduk is grim enough. Last time we talked about Marduk, the one who took over kingship by offering, when the gods had failed to subdue chaos after several attempts, by offering to the deliberative council of the early deities his heroic efforts if they would make him king of the gods. And it's very important to remember that his successful battle with the goddess of salt water and the god of fresh water, which led to the creation of the universe as portrayed in the Epic of Creation, somewhat in a scheme like we have up here, was associated very closely, if not identified with, Marduk's assumption of kingship over the gods, which then, in the course of our pursuit of the issue of the relationship between deities and humans, leads to the fact that by the period we're interested in, the 6th century BC, and for 1,200 years before that, if you want to talk about tenure, and that's real tenure, with a slight interruption during his sabbatical, when Asher took his place up in the north, Marduk became and remained the king of the gods, and as the son of the sky god, Anu, the giver of kingship. And last time we talked about how that was reenacted every year with the participation of the king of Babylon, I didn't hand him out yet. The reinstitution of the king of Babylon as king if he satisfied Marduk's requirements. Remember that in the Babylonian tradition of kingship, the king is not the priest of the high god as he was in Assyria, and combined the headship of the palace and the temple in one, but at the time of the New Year festival, he had to humble himself, be slapped by the priest, having taken off all his robes of office, and given his mace to somebody to hold and all of that. And if he showed real tears and made an adequate confession and the ritual went right, he became king again, and then was allowed to take the hand of the god Marduk's image, which then went on a parade from the temple, down the processional way, through the Ishtar Gate, over the bridge, to a place called the House of the New Year Festival. Behind Marduk came other gods, primarily the other six of the top seven. One of the strong traditions of Babylonian polytheism is that among the gods there were seven supreme gods who were the determiners of destiny. What makes it confusing for those of us who are more acquainted with monotheism, at least official monotheism, is that the powers of these gods shared and distributed among them, and also overlapping, changed enough through time that some gods' places were usurped by others, coming from other countries, at times when influences came, etc. But the number seven remained constant. And in some of the things we look at tonight, you will see various representations of the sevenness of human destiny. During the New Year's festival, the new king, who may have been the prior king as well, is reinstituted, reinvested, reclothed in his garments, takes the hand of Marduk, which is the hand that gives kingship, leads the parade of the other high gods who are brought from their nearby sanctuaries in Sippar, Bor Sippa, and other places like that, which are their cities, as Babylon was Marduk's city. The destinies of the coming year were also determined. How was so well known that they don't tell us about it, and consequently we don't know the answer. It's kind of like in the Old Testament, you say they cast lots and nobody knows what that was. Well, some people think they do, but nobody can really demonstrate to the satisfaction of more than 10 other people that they know what it is, except that they did it and somehow they got guidance out of it. These things were so well known that they didn't have to be explained. Those things which we could discover, even in the variegated group that we are, things that we all take for granted and never explain. We just assume that that's the way things are. So you had new kingship, new destinies, and in fact you had the recreation of the world in a kind of mythic way in which the reenactment is real in itself, but it contains also the original act of creation being renewed. There's something kind of threatening about that, as I think we look at it, and that is that the chances are that once a year everything's going to fall apart. Now, some of us would settle for once a year. Charlie Brown would certainly settle for once a year. But I remember a story about a little girl a colleague of mine adopted. And around Christmas time one year, about this time of year, she began to get very depressed. And they were about to send her to a doctor because they couldn't find out what was bothering her. Until one time, and in a moment of candor, she said she didn't want to die. And they said, "What makes you think you're going to die?" And she said, "Well, look on the wall. There are no more days after December 31st. Well, there's a sense in which the meaning of repeated rituals like the New Year's festival suggests that there may very well be no New Year. It all depends. And if it comes, it's a gracious gift from Marduk. And if it comes, it's because the king, the representative of the people, has managed to show sufficient sorrow, confession, true repentance, and commitment to be accepted once again or anew. Now, one of the things you should conclude from that is the kingship was not something people voted on. Wasn't like the kingship in Ebla, 7-year term, renewable once or twice, maybe. It was more like the young life of a lot of people, maybe some of you in this room, born in the 1930s, and America had only one president, it seemed forever. Kingship is a gift. No, it isn't a gift, it's the gift. It is the gift against disorder. It's so closely related to what Marduk did and does that the king becomes the representative of Marduk as the symbol, as well as the power and authority, effective, administrative, executive power and authority of kingship. And so to rebel against the king, of course, is also to indulge in religious apostasy. You can't just change kings. Change gods has to take place. One of the things we'll come back to next Tuesday, Monday, and elaborate some next Wednesday is that the last king of Babylon apparently indulged in trying to change the gods himself and disaffected the establishment of Babylon so much so that they welcomed a Persian conqueror as their savior from the disorder of the time. Whether that king went into exile in Arabia, as some people think, or went there to develop trade routes, we don't know. But that he was absent for 10 years, we do know. And in one of our most closest to history type documents from Babylon, we have a rather plaintive refrain in this annual chronicle called the Babylonian Chronicle. Marduk did not come out. Nebo did not come out. Nabu did not come out. The New Year's festival was not celebrated because the king was away. The tie-up between kingship and Marduk, the order of the world, order of life, is very close. All the more poignant, therefore, is a poem which I want to read to you called I Will Praise the Lord of Wisdom. It's about Marduk. And if you're familiar with the Old Testament, it's very much like the most frequent type of psalm we have in the Old Testament, which is called the complaint or the lament psalm, in which the singer, poet, addresses God with titles about his power and all, and then says, why are things as bad for me as they are right now? Where are you? How long is it going to be before you do something? I'm surrounded by enemies. They're like dogs at my feet. One of them is very important in the New Testament, the one where they cast lots for my garments, Psalm 22. Lament. A lament is really an act of faith because it springs from a conviction that God is just, but it springs also from the inexperience of injustice and pain. So listen to this one. I'll read you just three parts of it. The beginning, the address to Marduk, some of the complaint, just a part of the complaint goes on and on and on and on, as it often does in the Psalms in the Old Testament, and then the resolution at the end. The Epic of Creation, which I mentioned earlier, which was read in its entirety on the fourth day of the New Year's festival as part of the ritual, the renewal of the creative acts which are described there by Marduk and ascribed to Marduk, ends in the latest version, which comes from the period 6th century BC we're interested in. It ends with a list of the 50 names of Marduk. Does that ring a bell? The 50 names? And these names are names of former deities or kind of worn out deities or even some important ones whose functions are now encompassed in Marduk's functions. I think it's very hard to be a monotheist. I think about the only thing I can think of harder than being a polytheist to keep track of who's in charge of what, and whether one is stronger than the other, and whose special day it is, and all that. Listen to this. I will praise the Lord of wisdom, the deliberative God, who lays hold of the night but frees the day. Marduk, the Lord of wisdom, the deliberative God, who lays hold of the night but frees the day, whose fury sounds, surrounds him like storm wind, but whose breeze is as pleasant as morning zephyr, whose anger is irresistible, whose rage is a devastating flood, but whose heart is merciful, whose mind is forgiving, the one whose hands the heavens cannot hold back, but whose gentle hands sustain the dying. Marduk, the one whose hand the heavens cannot hold back, but whose gentle hand sustains the dying. My God has forsaken me and disappeared. My goddess has cut me off and stayed removed from me. The benevolent spirit who was always beside me has departed. My protective spirit has flown away and seeks someone else. My dignity has been taken away, my manly good looks jeopardized. My pride has been cut off, my protection has skipped away. Terrifying omens have been brought upon me. I was put out of my house and wandered about outside. The omens concerning me are confused. Daily there is inflammation. I cannot stop going to the diviner and the dream interpreter. What is said in the street portends ill for me. When I lie down at night, my dream is terrifying. King, the very flesh of the gods, the son, S-U-N, of his people, his heart is enraged and cannot be appeased. Even though I stand praying, they are against me. And now that they are the seven major deities. They gather together, telling things that ought not to be said. The first said, I have made him want to end his life. The second says, I made him vacate his post. Likewise, the third, I shall take over his position. I will take over his house, says the fourth, and the fifth, and the sixth, and the seventh will pursue him. The group of seven has assembled their forces, merciless as a storm demon. They are one in flesh, united in purpose, their hearts rage against me and they are ablaze like fire. They agree on slander and lies about me. They have sought to muzzle my respectful mouth. Then he goes on at great length, many, many, many lines, to tell how bad it got, actually, how terrible it got. Then he says, it was Marduk who put a muzzle on the mouth of the lion who was eating me. It was Marduk who took away the sling of the one who was pursuing me and turned back his sling stone. The Lord took hold of me. That's Baal, B-E-L, the other name for Marduk. Baal, Lord. The Lord set me on my feet. The Lord restored me to health. He rescued me from the pit. He summoned me from destruction. He pulled me from the Kuwur River. He took my hand. The one who once struck me down, Marduk, now raised me up. He struck the hand of the one who struck me. It was Marduk who made him drop his weapon. Who but Marduk could have restored the dying to life? Marduk can even restore to life somebody already in the grave. Wherever the world the earth is laid and the heavens are extended, wherever the sun god shines and the fire god blazes, wherever water flows and winds blow, creatures whose clay Aruru took in her fingers, those endowed with life walk about. Humanity, all of it gives praise to Marduk. May he, the shepherd of all inhabited places, rule all the peoples. Do you see his merciful heart in that picture? Looks grim, doesn't it? It's kind of surprising to read these descriptions of the gentleness and mercy and awe of Marduk when most of the representations are like this, pictures of power. Now, we haven't talked too much about these composite animals down below, and we're going to get to those next week because I want to take them all together. That one is a, though I want to mention, is a lizard with quadruped's feet and long spiked horns, which come from some other animal. Most of the animals you see under the pedestals for the deities, or at their feet, or on a rope and held by their hand, are composite. And in that procession of the gods we looked at the other night, we saw various deities associated with various animals. In that case, most of them were not composite. They looked like bulls and horses and goats and whatever. To be noticed in this picture again, which we've looked at before, are the celestial symbols with which Marduk's garment is covered. Stars, suns. I can't find a clear moon symbol on there. This could be one, but I don't think so. But what it is, I don't know either. Marduk, the young bull of the sun god at one time, became the supreme god and created a world of three zones. The sky, the underworld, and the earth in the middle. With the heavenly ocean around the whole thing. You have to kind of imagine like a balloon or pumpkin with openings at the side for the sun, which comes through one of these gates, moves across the heaven, goes out and makes a trip through the underworld at night on a boat, and then starts it over again. The subtitle of tonight's presentation is The Sun God, the Moon God, the Regulators. I think that's a very good word for them. The other of the two supreme gods who travel in the sky is the moon, and here I've tried to represent the moon's phases. Not an artist. You'll notice when we look at the symbols tonight that the moon god, as we've seen before, is usually represented by the crescent that first appears. Not the final one over here on the left-hand side, but the one on the right or slightly toward the bottom. It's thought that that symbol is particularly related to the moon's first appearance at the beginning of its 29.5-day cycle. Moving, I've just got arbitrary movements in this direction. There's no east and west in the picture. The other one we talk about next time is Ishtar, Venus, evening star, morning star. Down here, surrounded by a sea, is the earth, which is described in ways that suggest that it is like a mountain, and that ziggurats, those temple towers we've looked at, may very well be representative of it, touching heaven and the underworld. When Marduk succeeded in subduing the god of chaos, he killed the freshwater god, Apsu. He split Tiamat in half, the saltwater goddess, and stretched her out like kind of a like a water bag, a skin water bag, or a balloon. And so she's the one that holds the heavenly ocean out. Now, if we put all the details in this picture, be as cluttered as that thing I had the other night, maybe more so be. But you've got to think of some openings up here, windows kind of where they can be open to let the rain fall. So the rain comes from outside. Underneath down here is the zone where the dead gods, the defeated gods, are located, and from which evils, spirits, and demons originate and influence life on earth. And we'll come back to that next week when we talk about divination and magic rituals that are designed to prevent these spirits of disorder from disordering Marduk's universe. Very orderly place, pretty neat, with these regularly progressing heavenly bodies, with Venus related to both of them, as evening and morning star, with a 29 and a half day cycle for the moon, and the sun's regular cycle. You can imagine, I suppose, and if you will imagine, just about anything you can imagine related to eclipses is somewhere described in Babylonian literature. The spookiness, the scariness, the fear, the awe, the distress, all of that. Strangely enough, it is quite common in polytheisms, of which there are many, for usurpation and displacement and shifts of powers and assignments to be explained, if that's the right term, by creating familial relationships, so that Marduk, who displaces the sky god as the giver of kingship and as the ruler, is ever after called the sun, the sky god. And Shamash, the sun god, who was also at one time a dominant power in an earlier version of the Babylonian universe, and becomes a regulated heavenly body in Marduk's scheme, he becomes the sun, S-O-N, of Marduk, as well, now this is where it gets complicated, as well as being a son of the moon god, for reasons that I don't understand. I don't think you and I, you know, to create a polytheism, would ever make the moon the father or parent of the sun. But they did. Ishtar, his sister, to the sun, daughter, and moon at this particular time. Remember, we keep talking about the particular period because there are lots of shifts and fluidity and all the rest at other times. Because we're talking about something that began before the Sumerians in various forms that can be guessed at, and then a Sumerian versions, which can be described pretty well now. There are more tablets in Sumerian available now than there are in Akkadian, and there are hundreds of thousands of those. Then the Akkadian version early on, the Assyrian aberration of it, with Ashur displacing the sun god and Marduk, And then the Neo-Babylonian revival of the 7th and 6th centuries BC, in which Marduk, once again in his own city Babylon, becomes the dominant figure. But not alone, always in a kind of council of the gods, always with companions, with distribution of assignments. Sometime tonight, I need to show you the cleaned up version I made of that city scheme, but may hold that to later in view of the movement of the clock. And what we're going to do next is let you do something interesting, I hope. Using what we've already done to identify gods and goddesses by the way in which they were portrayed, particularly on cylinder seals. Yes, I will be. This schematic of the city organization for now, the main thing I want to point out is that the cylinder seals, because of their size and the portability, are the most widely distributed artistic artifact of Babylon. They're found in Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, Asia Minor, Persia, you name it. They're all over because soldiers could carry them. They were individualized, many of them. They were like signatures. You could roll them across soft clay, soft material, and identify that as yours, or identify its contents, or something like that. And these cylinder seals, which I have put on here in all the places from the inner city to the outer city to the harbor for export and import, and I should have put them on the roads going out with the soldiers and the traders and caravanners and the donkey drivers and, you know, everybody. We haven't done too much with them, but tonight we're going to look at a few roughly presented in chronological order. And the purpose is to ask you to begin to notice identifications which we've already dealt with, and then I'll point out other identifications, particularly with respect to sun and moon. We're dealing here with art, very difficult art, working with a little round cylinder. In which the artist with these two incised the picture into the cylinder seal. Now we're working a round surface, hard material, stone, metal. They put it in. In such a way that when it was rolled across a soft material, you got a positive picture, a raised, low relief picture, and you got a repetitive scene, border, central, content, focus, and the ways in which the deities are represented on here with respect to humans and their relationships is very important, I think, because the cylinder seals, unlike the images confined to the temple, or even the replicas which traveled with the king, or the symbols of that reflected the deities that were set up when the image was absent in on procession or something, the cylinder seals are prolific and portable. And I suggested with whether they had writing on them or not, which a lot of them did, that we probably ought to take them more seriously as giving us some clues to the common man in Mesopotamia and Babylon, whom most scholars say we know virtually nothing about, because our records are largely official records written by scribes in the palace or the temple. The images and other things like that were more confined, but these cylinder seals are everywhere. Remind you again of the procession, the practice of taking the gods of the city away from it when it was conquered. And this sheet, oh, I know what I forgot to do. The rest of these will show without the book on it. Have been through this once. This is a summary and an inventory of the various kinds of symbols that occur on the cylinder seals to in association with the representation of the deity. Let's see how many of them you already recognize. In the first row, are there any that you recognize from what we've done before? Which? The spade. Right here, it has some dingleberries on it. And it's on a kind of pedestal, but that's Marduk's pole or spade for digging the canals and making the furrows. Bringing water. We have not seen this one before, but we will see it tonight. This is a plow. May not look like a plow to you, but there's the point of the plow right there. And I think in one of them you're going to see the plow with the seed holder on it. They had a plow in Babylon that went along and dropped the seeds in. How about any in the second row? Well, we've got some horns, remember, that we found regularly on the hat of the deity. And the more rows of horns there are, the higher the deity. You can tell the rank of deities when there's more than one represented by that. And here, the crescent here. Notice what the crescent is on. It's on a pedestal that represents a building. And then perhaps a kind of very abstract ziggurat with a ladder up. Okay? What about here?
With the moon god in the middle.
Right there, two of them. We have the crescent and the crescent as part of a disc. And another one, a little old god riding in the moon. Man in the moon, in case you've been wondering. Another one, a crescent on a pedestal with a necklace, a post, and then this thing, can you see that well enough to see what those bases are?
Animals' feet, isn't it?
Yeah, animals' feet. They're hooves, aren't they? What animal have we seen Marduk on? Well, we just saw him on that composite lizard. Next time you see that lizard, look at his feet, see whether they're that kind of feet. Have you seen that one before? No. This is... How about that?
Oh, no, Venus.
8 points is Venus. Yeah. Ishtar. Sometime on a disc. No. What about that? Sun.
Sun.
Sun, 4 points, and radials, rays in between, on a post.
That's sun, dude?
That's sun.
Mm-hmm.
This is the sun with wings. You're going to see him again, too. Here's a big one. Wings with a man in the middle of it and a bow and arrow. You'll see it better on the other. The winged solar disk is a very important symbol, especially up north. The Assyrians developed this one. Often appears over the king's chariot when he's proceeding into battle as the assurance that he's going to win. That's a variation on a theme. Here's horn crown on a temple facade. Doesn't tell you which god it is, unless that little thing on top may tell you. This one I haven't seen. This one you're familiar with because of its prevalence in Egypt and the Christian. This is the Ansata cross, the sign of the eternal life. In Egyptian names, when you have the word Ankh, A-N-K-H, that's that. Ankh is what gods give to kings in Egypt. I hope so. What's that look like to you? An eye. And I would never have identified this as an eye, except that the Mexicans make things just like that that are called the Eye of God. You've seen those, right? Yeah. They weave them out of yarn. See? All right. Let's see if we've got any more here. What about that? You seen that before? Does it look like anything to you?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm?
Spade. Elephant.
Well, it's shaped. It's wedge shaped. These are cuneiform signs. And this is a sign of the moon god, who's the patron of scribes and wisdom. It appears singly, doubly, horizontally, and then these two things are also scribal equipment, and you see they're set up on a temple facade. Moon god, right there. Let's see if there are any others here we've had.
Didn't we have a staff?
Yeah, we had a staff, but not a crook. Well, maybe we did. You'll see some later. What that looks like, shepherd's crook? That's the shepherd deity. Amuru, same word as Amorite, comes into Babylonian, into the Babylonian picture with the first, with the time of Hammurabi, when the Western Semites influenced things. Amuru, another one. Notice he's got a little animal holding it up there. Here's a dog with one on the head. Sheepdog, undoubtedly. Look at all these geezers. We had that one before. That's the ram scepter of Ea, who is Marduk's father, another father we had, who was, Marduk is, Ea is the god of, fresh water, rivers, and because rivers are so circuitous, and because they find new channels and all that, he's a god of cunning, of devices and strategies and all of that. He's also a fructifying god. He gives water. Notice his animal with big horns. Christmas tree. We've had this one before. Remember the procession of the deities, the seven deities with the king at either end? Each one of them had that hand, right hand. And in the Shamash, at the top of the Hammurabi stele, we had him holding it out and Hammurabi kind of standing back. And in another one, we have the king kind of looking to get it. This is found in the hands of all the high gods, the seven biggies, and apparently stands for the determination of destiny. Remember that thing from the early inscription we saw, the picture of Shamash holding it where it looked like a rope with a coil and then attached to a rod? Some people think it's a measuring rod that therefore leads to such things as the symmetry of justice, the order of justice, and the measuring of right and wrong. But I don't know whether that's right or not. That's supposed to look like an arrow. An axe, these go together with a God we haven't come to yet. This is a juggler. And this is a guy we're going to look at now. Here's some more Nauvoo signs, cuneiform sign, the wedge-shaped writing. Now, with that brief review in mind, let's look at some pictures of actual seals. Hope you don't have to squint too hard to see them. Maybe without the light would be better. Okay, is that better? All right. Now, according to all reports, Babylonians were humans, Homo sapiens as we are. And it may not be out of order to have us think about what if we were Babylonians, what these kinds of symbols might mean to us. Now, our answers would probably be wrong, but maybe our question is right. Or maybe our answers would have some clue in them. Let's not say we know, but let's guess. I don't know if you're good at guessing or imagining or anything, but let's try.
Preston, let me ask one question first. On these cylinder seals, you're saying that you think it's wise to look at them and try to find out what the common man was doing. You're talking about the common man who's going around various parts of this part of the world.
Their distribution.
What would they be using them for? Would they be using them for identification of themselves?
Documents, signing. Okay. Signing. Clay tablets when they're still wet,
okay.
Marking pots of contents, all kinds of things like that. Think of them as signet rings.
Okay.
You know, something, remember the signet ring is the way they used to sign to make a signature with a piece of wax in it, like that, you knew it came from the real guy.
Okay?
Do you recognize anything or anybody in the top row? Date palms, yes. People often call these sacred trees. Well, they really were. We said last time, you know, how many things the people made from the date palms in Babylonia? Sugar, wax, wood, brews. And I did check with somebody and found out that yes, the new shoots of palm tree do, in fact, taste something like artichokes or celery and can be eaten the same way. I had my suspicions about that. I checked with a local authority from Texas, where we have palm trees.
Is that a moon up there?
Moon. Moon. Winged sun, kind of abstract. Are these deities? They got crowns, see, they got horns. This one doesn't, though.
Is he being dark to the god?
No, not in this case. They're tending this tree, you see, under the influence of the sun god, moon god. How many of those are there?
Seven.
Seven. Don't forget that.
Mm-hmm.
How about this one?
Yes, sir.
You got a god on the chair here. And
sun.
Sun. Another thing looks like stylized palm tree. He's pretty early. Look at this one. I'm not trying to analyze all this. I'm going to focus on some of them later, but tonight I just want to run through and look at various ways you see these.
Is that Venus or the sun in the middle of that?
8 points. I think I would go for Venus. Here's the sun god. And the moon.
Yeah.
One of the things you're going to notice is a trinity. Sun, moon, Venus. What do they have in common? Light. They're the three brightest bodies in heaven. And they're all associated in their movements with each other and with the earth. The Venus is the evening star and the morning star.
God has his feet on the mountains.
Yep, feet on the mountain. Suggest who it might be? Usually the god with his feet on the mountain is the sun god who rises in the morning between and above the mountains, comes over them.
What is the scale of this? Something fairly small, like 15, 20 millimeters.
You don't mean in the picture, you mean in the book that I took it from?
Anywhere
from about an inch to almost 2 inches. Oh yeah, these are small. They worn on a thong around your neck. There's a hole through the middle of them. These are the impressions. Anything else you see here? We'll move along. The important point is not to analyze everyone, but to see some of the varieties of ways in which they do it. Who's this god? Well, he doesn't have his foot on a mountain. He's got some kind of animal. And he's twirling these pomegranates. See anything recognizable in that one, or this one, this, this?
See a couple moons in there.
Oh yeah, lots of moons all around. You see, you know, think of the associations of the moon. Think of the close associations of the moon with human life, with women's periods, gestation periods, and other things which we have formalized, you know, to book descriptions, but those people experience very directly. And how could one avoid the association of human life with the moon when there are so many correlations? Yes, so some of these have inscriptions on them. Look at all the symbols. Look at these characters. Have you seen robes like this before anywhere? On deities, right? Let's look at some more. Oops, over there. Now this one's interesting in that the picture is cut in like a cameo, is that right? Cameo? It was raised on the cylinder seal and it's into the material, whereas most of them are the reverse. I can't hear you.
I see animals. Which is that? That one has the rock.
Which one?
Second from the bottom on the right.
This one? That's a crook. See, that's the shepherd's crook. Notice the different kind of cap this guy has on. He's out of style. Babylonian gods are supposed to have different kind of hats. Well, he's not a Babylonian. He came from the west. He came from up in North Syria. He's Amuru, the god of the shepherd, people who speak Aramaic. Slingshot, or some kind of weapon. After all, shepherds used rocks to keep the sheep and wine, they throw things at animals that might disturb them. What else you see? And in which picture? We haven't talked about the scorpion god, and I'm not going to. It's bad enough to think anybody could make a god out of a scorpion without trying to figure out what it means. Obviously not a good god. Anything else you see in there? Got more? Ah, here's one. Somebody wanted a tree. Another tree. What kind of tree is this?
Pomegranate.
That's right. Cultivated very early in Babylon.
Smart.
Is that a spade?
A what?
On the right-hand side, the second from the
that?
Top. Yeah. Well,
That's Marduk's spade.
That's his animal on the bottom.
And that's his animal. Look at that. That's a lizard-like thing with two horns and feet. Look at all of them.
That's Marduk.
Look at this one, like seven. That's, well, which is Marduk? This is Marduk here. That's not Marduk there. That's a lady.
That's
or a woman. What?
That's a symbol for Marduk.
This is a symbol for Marduk. That's his symbol. He's the canal digger, the irrigation giver.
What is this? For instance, take the top one on the left, top left corner. If you were taking that to somewhere, what's it mean? I mean, what is it saying? You have authority for what?
Well, I don't know what the scriptures say.
Well, obviously, a guy with that, once he puts that on some paper or something, he's got some authority.
Yeah. Do you have any bosses or friends whose signatures can't be read, but you recognize them?
Yeah.
Okay,
so just long as you're saying as long as the deities or whatever's on it is recognized,
kind of, unique combination thing.
Okay.
But look who the characters are. The fact is that when they opted to present deities on their identification means, they're on their ID cards. Your ID card, what does it have on it? U.S. Embassy, right? Mm-hmm. Have a deity on it? Whose authority is on there? Is there a seal?
Yeah.
Whose seal?
U.S. seal, yeah.
Ronnie Reagan?
Probably.
Yeah. Well, you see, we're talking about who is the authority, who are the powers of the world of which this individual's, which is are represented on this individual's cylinder seal. It's a statement, an artistic statement. That?
Yes.
That's a standard with a sun disk on it. They like those dingleberries. They like to stick them on those standards right under the official symbol.
Then, who declared it like Margaret C., for instance?
Who?
Who? Which person?
We don't know who carried it.
What kind of person would carry Marduk's seal?
You find them in contexts where you think a soldier must have had them, or you find them in a place where a worker, tradesman must have had them. They're found everywhere.
Not a priest, not necessarily a priest.
I don't know. Maybe so. But we have some that identify the person involved as a priest. This one has a lot of these trees on it. Again, telling you that the association is with agriculture, with fertility, with productivity, with sustenance of life. Because these are the symbols of order and fertility and welfare. That's Lady Ishtar. There she is again. Look at all the seven dots in there. Some people think that's the Pleiades. I think it's a toss-up myself, but. This guy seems to be holding up the sun god or raising his hand under the auspices of the sun god in relationship to this human here, probably an authority figure sometimes.
All these seals belong to Babylonia or some of them Assyrian as well?
These are Assyrian.
Assyrian.
Assyrian of the 9th and 8th centuries. We've been moving rapidly, skipping and jumping through time.
There seems to be at least on two of those, top left-hand corner and center, guy with bow and arrow, as if he's about to shoot at some type of animal.
Killing demons, and notice he's got horns, and he's a deity who is chasing some of these demons.
What about the one in the middle, is that a deity too?
Right here?
Yeah.
I don't know. Right. It doesn't look like it. Oftentimes, a hunter or somebody quelling an animal like that will have a symbol of a deity above him, telling who is empowering him to deal with that problem.
Someone's blessing.
Here are some.
Can I see the
rocks? Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a ziggurat temple. Fascinating variety, isn't it? I want you to know that it's a huge range of these things, and that when we select certain things, we're selecting out of a composite context.
Are those demons at the bottom left? No, on either side.
Yes.
Do they always have wings?
No, some of them have wings. Depends on what kind of composite you wanted to make. Look at this poor guy battling this huge monster, but he's got the sun god on his side. Here is the sun god with a plow. One of the sun god's attributes who travels every day was plowing the furrows. Here's a presentation scene. We've seen this before. A lesser god taking a human by the hand to present it to a deity. Another one, another presentation scene. Notice the prayer position and the kind of introduction position. Here's a god with a mace, symbol of power.
What are those writings on the side?
Those are small cuneiform inscriptions. Yeah, it's cuneiform. And some more.
What would it be if there's something for the gods or something related to the owner of the city?
The owner, oftentimes the owner, telling you who he is, and what he does. Sometimes it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the picture. Oftentimes, far removed. Now, when we come back to these Wednesday night and next Monday, we're going to look at what things occur at the bottom, down where humans live on the ground, how the deities and the humans are addressed and related, and then the auspices or the celestial or power figures that are represented at the top in a scene, for instance, like this. And we'll focus on individual ones that, in my judgment, are typical. Whether my judgment's correct is something you'll have to figure out someday. But I don't think it's correct. Now, whatever you see in the meanings of these, you've got to admire the workmanship and the art, and remember that the moon god was the patron god of the arts and craft, as well as the scribes. Isn't it interesting that the pictures we have and the documents we have according to Mesopotamian theology all come to us under the sponsorship of the moon god. Here, we'll stop with this one, is the sun god traveling in his boat through the underworld so that he can come up again tomorrow morning, come up from the mountains with the help of Ishtar, and Ea, the god who sends water to the earth, which the fish swim in. And